be, at least in our involvement here, it was another friendly judge that came on the scene, Judge Wickersham, said that you'd better go out and fight for your land. And I know for a fact that one of our, from Kassan, Willard Jones, now living in Ketchikan, is one of our former members of Kassan that said that if their land claims is not settled, we'll take it to the United Nations. So we've had a strong commitment for a long time to be involved with this process. A little history about Kassan that probably worth mentioning is that around 1900, it moved from the old village to a new village.
Could I just have your name for the record?
Oh, Willard Jones. And one of the reasons that the people moved is there was a sawmill that was there, and the people were entering a new era and learning how to make money to complement their subsistence lifestyle. One of the bad things that happened, once you move from the traditional village, the traditional cultural concepts were not as strong in the new village as it was in the old village. So we lost a certain amount of our heritage and our culture. But we did pick up a little bit of the new culture that we were being exposed to. Because of location and means of travel, Kassan was somewhat isolated, even though we were 30 miles from Ketchikan. And during my growing up years, the sole employer at Kassan was a salmon cannery, the home office in Bellingham, Washington. The only benefit that we got from it was those people that stayed at Kassan and worked in the cannery, all the men and the people of fish boats, fish for a processor in Ketchikan. The students in the village, for various reasons and depending on the grade level, went to boarding school at Wrangell and then Mount Edgecombe, or Sheldon Jackson and Sitcom. Those people that lived in Ketchikan, I think, had probably more exposure to the Western influence that was affecting us. And even though we're 30 miles away, we're somewhat isolated and not too greatly influenced by the Western culture that was engulfing us. Although we were isolated, there were a number of people that were talented and enterprising entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them. They were able to get into boat building, carpenters. It amazed me the amount of talent that they had learned. During my younger years, I was aware that things were happening that wasn't happening outside of our village, that wasn't happening within the village. And part of that was in my early adult, I guess around 1953, that the pulp mill came into being. And we had heard a long time that we owned all the land from Narrow Point, which is about 40 miles north of here, to Cape Shack, and that was all land owned by the Haidas from Kassan. And as the tugboats hauled out a million board feet rafts day in and day out, we had great expectations that something was going to happen soon and some of that money would become ours. I think that I might be able to agree a little bit with Paul Young in his statement that the act was a failure. Somehow I anticipated or heard the people saying that once we get our land claims settled, we will be able to do a lot of things. This is the Klinkahida land claims. That came along and nothing happened. There's one thing that greatly influenced us. You have heard that once the Klinkahida went to court and did in fact prove that we owned the land, that we get a lot of benefit. But they since then have taken a different course, so that we then base our hopes on the land claims pushed by the new group of leaders. And once that is settled, we're kind of floundering now, not knowing what's going to happen. So if the intent of the act was to have the Indians fit into the mainstream or acculturation or whatever terminology we want to do it, so that we can become a self-sufficient people, has not happened yet. So for our dreams, I guess it'd be called a great American dream, that is still something we're looking for. Maybe we'll live in hopes and die in despair. I think the U.S. federal government finally found a way of making a white man out of me. They've been trying for 400 years. What I mean is that for a great many years, you've had nothing but a lot of money spent, reservations, federally funded programs that would make the Indian people fit into the mainstream USA. I think something went wrong between the Indian people and those newcomers that came into the land. Some of my relatives and my wife's relatives and ancestors and friends were pretty good musicians. They were able to understand and become very proficient in playing music. And they were, I've heard a lot of good things about playing a number of instruments. That was the first contact that we had with this new group of people coming. Then we reached a point where there was a lack of these kind of things happening. Even though that like the village of Xan was somewhat isolated, they and other people had very good, talented people. They had a sawmill that was mentioned. In fact, it was in the location of the airport. We had a great number of boat builders and other talents that they could change their lifestyle. Comes 1971, then we were thrust into this new world, and we were expected to run before we learned how to crawl. I had the opportunity of attending the signing of the bill in Anchorage when President Reagan signed the act, and a lot of people were very happy. For some reason, I was not happy. I think now that some of the stuff I've heard on the television that others are learning now that why I felt a certain amount of sadness, even though we were awarded somewhere around $900 million. Probably my point is that we were expected to do an awful lot in Kasan, and Kvilka has done well, probably as well as the top village corporation in the state for returning at least money to our shareholders. But before the other can do it, I think it takes it's been mentioned a lot of times that it takes a long time to learn how this new entity works, and I guess that's my problem. How much time do we need so that we understand the corporate structure? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Williams? Yeah, I can always rely on you. And
Frederick Williams, Ketchikan again. Oh, this time I would like to discuss the issue of sovereignty. It seems like the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act didn't touch at all on the sovereignty issue. In fact, it's a very misunderstood issue in the state right now. Some folks are saying that we do have it, and some folks are saying that we don't have it. And I think the Alaska Claims Act was dealing strictly from the standpoint of economic power, and it didn't touch on the idea of political power. And it seems that we are a country. We all claim our separate nations. We all know the history of our nations, and we all have our hopes and dreams for the future of our nations, aside from the fact that we are Americans, and we do all have the American dream. We each hope for the best. And I think the point being, as far as our own particular sovereignty is concerned, is just what form it will take. The stumbling block we have is that the Tlingit Nation, as an example, never had one ruler. There were many chiefs, but we had one language, and that was our ruler. As I could see, I can't say it for a certainty, but that was the way it was. If you spoke Tlingit and you traced your mother's lineage, and then you belonged to the Tlingit Nation, which did never have a king. You had your own local chiefs. And this is the problem we're having now, is we've got the Tlingit and Haida, we've got the Sea Alaska, we've got the ANS, ANB. We've got many different leaders right now, and our problem is, how do we focus it into the American system where you have one supreme leader, supreme commander, that's totally alien to our thoughts, our ways of thought. I suppose if any one man in the past would have had the power to conquer all other of the tribes, and then we would have had a supreme leader. But things weren't quite that way, so we had a lot of separate leaders, and we did all work together. The Tlingits ranged as Copper River, down here to Cape Fox, as far as the native lands. And as far as the leaders go now, we've got the additional problem with the natives in this area do come from other nations, and so we're kind of united, but we could see what America has done. America calls itself the melting pot, and these people have joined together from many different nations, and they've created the greatest nation in the world. So I think if the commission was to do anything, it would be to address the idea of sovereignty and the ways that we can go ahead. And I claim dual citizenship now. I'm American. I'm proud to be an American. And I'm also a native. And that doesn't say I don't say I'm Tlingit or I'm a native, and I'm brother to other natives, whether they are Tlingit or Haida or Tsimshian. And I would like to see the people that could possibly do it to pull us all together, and so that we can all wear one hat. Sometimes it's kind of confusing to me when I mean to say Indian, I will say Tlingit. And then I'll look up and I'll say, oops, because I know we're not all Tlingit, as much as I feel that we all should be, just because I am and my grandmothers were. So I would like to see the ability for me to call my natives from other nations as brothers, and we could all join together into whichever group it would take. I don't see to me, it's a little bit impossible for all the natives of Alaska to join together as one nation, possibly later. But right now, the Eskimos, the Aleuts, and the Tlingits are pretty much worlds apart. And so I think it would be better to break us down into states so that we could then join together as a nation. Nation of indigenous people. Thank you.
My name is Wallace Johnson. I'm with the Tlawah Kenya Corporation. And my concern is with the land. The money no longer seem to bother me at all anymore, because I haven't seen any of it. It's bypassing us to other resources. Just a short time ago, I went to visit my home in Tlawah, flew over there. Most of our forest areas is pretty well cut down. And why it's happening, I don't know. Because so far I haven't heard any reports from our corporation officers over there. But to everyone I ran across, it has been my deep concern with the land, because I come from the land myself. My family, my tribe come from Tlawah. They were the first ones that found that area. And other tribes joined us when the BIA government brought us together. Like all other nations in the South 48, they pick up a piece of land for the Indian people. And a lot of times we lose our rights to our original land. A lot of my father's land is pretty well cut down in Chican area, Tukin area, and Tlawah itself. I'm not too sure just how it's going to wind up in 91 as people are concerned. But the people I talk with, my only concern is the land. It has brought us thus far. The only reason why I moved away from Tlawah was the economy. I had to find work elsewhere and went to school elsewhere other than my home. And in some ways, the BIAs have helped, and in a lot of ways, we have lost along the way also. They treated us like we were wards to the government. They gave us things free. We began to become used to that way of life. And it was a struggle as you go to school to come out of that area again. Some have made it, and still some of them are struggling with it. But at the same time, some of our educated people have gone elsewhere or have been placed in other areas, rather than to help our little communities. But back in the territorial days, our people were close, very close. They never had any need for any money or anything because we had the land. Even in the Depression years, in the 30s, our people never knew anything about depression until we become educated in these years. We learned something about depression. The only thing I can say is my concern for the land. I thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Well, my name is Richard Keita, and I haven't been through all this settlement deal, but I've noticed when I was growing up, going to school, that we've been all our so-called resources and our values of our land and our rights. Seems like it's alienating us from our own natural habitat, and I don't know of any future that's going to bring to us. I think we're getting the covers pulled over our heads, you know, and everything's going too quick. And I think the federal government should understand that, you know, we're human too. And as far as the Native Land Settlement Act, I don't know too much about, but, you know, it came about in my time when I was growing up in a period, you know, where it has been, spread out among the people of Alaska. And it's not, who's winning, you know, the government or the people, you know? We couldn't bid on our own lands or do anything when Nixon was in power. He alienated all our corporations. That's why I think my own thought that we have been separated into corporations, because in a body of one, why would the state, we'd be too powerful for the state of Alaska. And my feelings are that we gotta find something. I think within ourselves to come together and negotiate about. Otherwise, we're going to lose out as a whole. And seeing all, well, like me, I'm from Tlaloc, and I got stocks in Sea Alaska, which in my own village, I don't have no vote in our say-so, you know. And going to Sea Alaska, that even further alienates me, being from here and having the greatest amount of Indians concentrate in one area and the rest all spread out. Where am I going, you know? I mean, where's the future, you know? Everybody's talking about future. I think there's too much, federal government taking too much, too quick, and not really educating the people on things. As far as I know, you know, like, who reads, you know, like, how many people read their, you know, daily or monthly reports from our corporation? Very few. And not having no response, you know, it's even worse. And I feel that there's got to be some sort of answer for us as a whole state. And I feel that we're not getting anywhere, and it's really a shame, you know, having all this progress, or so-called progress that, you know, we're all supposed to have, you know, like, and tariffs on our exported logs. How'd that come about, you know? Or we have enough taxes to pay. And I don't know, I think we're almost fighting almost a losing battle if we don't have any, if we don't meet halfway in between any our differences. And I hope someday we will be come into it all, you know. It should be right, you know. I believe in things that are right. I see things that are wrong that the state government is doing. And I feel that it's not really kosher with things, you know. And I feel sorry for our upcoming generation because of being rushed about our judgments about 1991 and when everything comes about, you know. And our proxies will dwindle, our share rights will dwindle as within the next generation to come. There'll be halves, quarters, you know, and our shares will not be full, you know. And as well as going to sell, who's going to have all, who's going to own it, you know? And I feel that our economy up here is going to its last extent, you know? Timber, fishing, everything's going down. How can we afford it? Cost money, you know. And I feel that we're almost to an extent that being extinct in our own natural resources. Well, that's all I got to say on my own behalf and thoughts of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keto. If there are any others that will be, as you know, we'll be resuming these hearings here in this room tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and we'll carry on tomorrow afternoon and then tomorrow evening at 7 again, and then Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday evening again. And I, of course, invite you to come to any or all of those hearings and to speak then, and if you've already spoken and have further thoughts, to come and make a further presentation. But we still have time this evening to hear one or two more people, if you'd like to. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just have a few thoughts as I've been sitting over there. My name is Estelle Thompson. I'm also from Kasan, and I'm speaking tonight as a representative from Kasan as the mayor. The impact that I see that ANSCA has had on the village of Kasan itself has really done a lot of good out there because of the corporation to the city itself. The village of Kasan had village status until just very recently, when we did incorporate and become a small city. As they have said ahead of me, there is approximately 60 people living in Kasan, which some are not natives. And our corporation represents probably 11 shareholders living in Kasan. The rest are not shareholders at this time. The corporation has plans of distributing 1.5 acres to each shareholder in the very near future, which will make a large impact on our small town.
To the shareholders living in Kasan, or to all
shareholders? No, to all shareholders.
And how many shareholders are there?
There's approximately 120.
And there'll about be 11 live in the...
11 live in the community at this time. Most of our shareholders are spread out, which makes the issue of the IRA council a difficulty in our town, because you have to live within 100 miles radius or in the city to belong to that IRA council. So as far as lands going to an IRA council or to a tribal government body, it's pretty hard to do out there. The village councils there are run by the native people in the town. We do have representation on Tlingit and Haida, and also IRA and our local chapter there. The taxation problem on our community is not of great value, because we are in a non-taxable area as of this time. Prince of Wales Island has no borough, or we're not governed by any taxing problems that way. The 1991 issue, to the me as a person, I don't look at it as a threat, because I think it'll take care of itself. The people, as you find out in growing and learning and becoming educated into what we're trying to do in the profit-making corporation, your people then become educated into it. And I think by 1991, that issue will take care of itself. Also, the inheritance rights, to me, I have no problem with that, because I think the people of our corporation realize, and they've all talked, and we all realize that in order to keep the corporation growing, you need to transfer that stock to your native shareholder. That is one provision I think that in ANSCA was not taken care of very good, was the fact that they allowed a person, when they died, to will their stocks to whoever they wanted to. It should not have happened. It should have been only willed to a native person. And I know that the elders, there has been many elders who are in elderly homes. In fact, I have had an aunt who was taken care of by people, and she left her stock certificates without realizing what was going on by being talked into something.
non-natives.
To non-natives, yes. Like I say, the impact to the city, I think, has been really good. We have a small sawmill started by our corporation out there, which has local hire. And like I say, the land being transferred to native shareholders will be a large impact out there. I feel that people, when they get that land, will either build summer homes or come back permanent in retirement times or whatever they want to do. We have a good school out there, and the little town is growing. So I feel that actually, as far as Anska itself, has a lot of problems in it. It should have been examined prior to settlement a lot further than it was, by more people than they had chosen. Such a small committee to say, this is the way we're going to live and this is what we're going to do. I think it should have been maybe brought to the vote of the people. Although, again, you run into the problem of you can't have a captain of the ship and so many other people running it. It has to be done. So the interests, I think, out there are falling into place really good, and I do believe that Kasan is up and coming. I'm really proud of it, very much. And I think our corporation has done a great job. I do think that other corporations have problems, but that's not for me to say, and it isn't any of my business. So anyway, I just wanted to say that I think this is working real great for our corporation. Although, like Willard stated, we have lost a lot of cultural things and heritage things. But you can always go back to them. We live out there. I just finished drying seaweed. We're getting ready to smoke fish. We have our meetings in our halls and get-togethers of our people, singing and dancing. The other day we had one shareholder came out who sat down and played the piano back to the music days of her own way of just sitting there and playing music. It came from her. She didn't have any book in front of her. So these things happen, and it's small communities that make them happen. And I think if everybody would get together and just sit down, potlucks bring people together. We have a lot of them. And I think Kasan is working great. I really do. It's up and growing, and we meet out. I stretch out on Prince of Wales Island. I was born on the other side. I was born in Craig. And I climbed the mountain to the other side to get my mate. That's why I settled in Kasan.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Yes, sir.
Ron, I'm Al Jackson again from Kewaukini in Sea, Alaska, and I just want to drop a few short comments here before I close tonight. One of them, of course, is IRA. And Mrs. Thompson's concerned that we do not have enough villagers to fully gain control of our land through IRA. But I served on a children's home board here in Ketchikan 2 years ago, and we sent a consultant from an oil firm who gave us information that by 1991, the cost of home heating fuel will be 21 times what it is in 1982. I was the only one that caught it on this board. There is judge, business people, teachers, and I asked when he left, did you get what he said? Oh yes, cost of home heating fuel is going to be expensive. So what else is going to be expensive? These are the very people that control the entire cost of living. They own the big banks, the big insurance companies, and they will very much tell you what the entire cost of living is going to be. I mentioned this to a friend of mine who's in the produce business in Anchorage. He said, you hit the nail on the head. This was 3 months ago. I talked to him. He said, we found out recently that the big companies, banks and insurance companies owned by big oil companies are buying up all the big major food produce markets and farmland that they can get their hands on, because in 1991 or thereabouts, in 10 years' time, they know that that's where the money is going to be. They will be able to dictate the price. This is the very reason that I asked our Village Corporation to 3 years ago to buy into a store that had a good trade route to the south. We have since done this in Klawak. We have Anika, which has 42 other villages up north. Now, where does this tie into IRA? The very thing that drove our people from our villages, a lack of work, a lack of economics, will drive them back home, and I give this 3 to 5 years at the most. For when the entire economy of our country starts tightening up and there are loss of jobs, our people are still the outsiders and they will be driven home. And we have to prepare for this. This is one of the things I wish we could push for harder. I know Kasan has already worked on this, as well as a few other villages, and that is a land distribution to the shareholders, which is under the law of the Native Land Claims Act. And the sooner they get this underway, the better. Also, concerning the plight of the 13th Regional Corporation, as known, they have 4,400 people, which essentially they came from all of the villages or all of the corporations in Alaska, and they lived outside the state and they chose to settle for money. I feel this is where their downfall is, in my opinion. They gave up their birthright. They sold their birthright for a small amount of cash. Okay, as known, they've lost $27 million in the last few years. If you divide that by 4,400 people, you come up with a figure of $60,136. Now, in my opinion, that this alone should be cause for a congressional inquiry into the entire Native Land Claims Act to prevent other corporations from following suit. If there is a criminal element within these corporations, let's dig it out now before it is too late. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for coming tonight and to say that it's been a good evening's discussion, and we're going to have two more days of discussion here tomorrow afternoon. Tomorrow evening, and then Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday evening, and I want to invite you to return tomorrow and indeed the next day, and to say how much how worthwhile I've found the contributions that have been made this evening, and to hope that you'll be back again tomorrow and the next day, and we'll renew the discussion at that time. And I do hope that before we close the meetings after we've heard from more of you on tomorrow and on Wednesday, that everyone who wishes to speak will have had an opportunity to do so. And I want to say, returning to what Mr. Thomas said early in the evening, that I too am pleased that we are meeting in a building dedicated to the memory of William Paul. His fame has spread beyond Southeast Alaska, and Dennis Demert recently, when I was in Fairbanks, played the tape for me of Mr. Paul's statement to the Native leaders at the time of ANCSA, and his views on ANCSA, which he expressed forcefully at the time, remain with me. So we'll adjourn for this evening. Thank you again, and I hope to see you tomorrow. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We scheduled these afternoon sessions so that people who might not be able to make it in the evening could drop in on us and testify, and so we're glad that you came this afternoon. I don't think there's any need for me to make any introductory statement, because I did that last night, and I'm sure people here today understand why I'm here and what the commission is doing. So I think we can just begin with the testimony this afternoon. The only other thing I should say is what I neglected to say last night, that my wife and I and Mary and Jeff, who traveling with us, did very much enjoy the potluck supper that the Alaska Native Sisterhood put on, and we want to express our thanks in getting started last night and making my long, rambling introductory statement. That was the one thing I overlooked, but I now amend that error. Well, we're ready to begin, and
this is Murder. My name is Christian Smith. I'm a professional wildlife biologist with undergraduate degrees in wildlife management and fisheries biology from the University of Alaska, and a Master of Science degree in wildlife biology from the University of British Columbia. For most of the past 15 years, I have studied and applied wildlife science in Alaska, BC, and the Yukon in positions ranging from a research associate to research project leader and senior field level management biologist. Throughout my career, the central focus of my work has been the relationships between wildlife species, particularly moose, mountain goats, and deer, and their habitat. Since 1972, I've been a member of the Wildlife Society, the organization of professional wildlife biologists in North America. In 1976, I was granted certification by the Society's Certification Review Committee. I've been active in the Alaska chapter of the Wildlife Society since 1978 and have served on the executive committee of that chapter since 1979. In my current capacity as Southeastern Regional Representative to the Executive Committee, I've represented the Alaska chapter on a Governor's Technical Committee appointed in the fall of 1982 to review the issue of conflicts between timber harvest patterns in Alaska and the habitat needs of Sitka black-tailed deer. It is with respect to the role of ANCSA on the issue of the impact of logging on wildlife and wildlife users that I've come forward to testify. I wish to point out that I'm representing the Alaska chapter of the Wildlife Society, and my comments here represent the concerns of professional biologists from both public and both the public and private sector, and are not intended, nor should they be taken as representing any agency, corporation, or organization other than the Alaska chapter of the Wildlife Society. Under terms of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, lands conveyed to Native people in Alaska were placed under the ownership and control of regional and village corporations, which were charged with, among other things, deriving benefits, specifically profits, from those lands for the shareholders. In southeastern Alaska, the Sea Alaska Regional Corporation and numerous village corporations set out to provide those benefits by selecting lands which were the highest potential value as commercial forest lands to the maximum extent possible under the selection guidelines. Following conveyance, most corporations have begun timber harvesting, some at accelerated rates, which will, if unaltered, deplete standing old growth timber within two decades. The fiscal or silvicultural rationale of the current large-scale conversion of old growth forests to largely unmanaged second growth stand is not my field of expertise. However, the consequences of these activities to wildlife and wildlife user groups are: research conducted in the past 10 years throughout coastal forest ecosystems from Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska has consistently confirmed that the old-growth hemlock spruce forests of this region are both preferred by and measurably more productive of black-tailed deer than our adjacent cutover or second-growth forest lands. Although research is currently underway in both British Columbia and Alaska to find ways of managing second-growth forest to improve its capability as deer habitat, no results are available to date which indicate that this is possible. Even if possible, given the marginal profitability of timber harvesting in Alaska, few but the most optimistic foresters foresee such activities as economically feasible. In short, as many published reports have already documented, logging is dramatically, and for all practical purposes, irreversibly reducing the potential of the forests of southeast Alaska to produce deer. Although not as thoroughly studied as deer, several other important species such as bears, geese, marten, and mountain goat have also been found to be more productive in old-growth forest systems and logging will reduce populations of these species as well. Combined with the reduced productivity of second growth forests, the accumulation of logging slash, particularly on Native Corporation clear cuts, where current utilization standards are much lower than on public lands, and the dense regeneration of young trees presents a significant physical barrier to wildlife and humans. The net result of this development is that within 10 to 15 years after harvesting, lands clear-cut in southeast Alaska will become virtually useless for such activities as subsistence hunting and trapping. Available evidence indicates that the value of these lands will remain drastically reduced for several centuries. The implications of the current large-scale clear-cutting on private lands on the future of subsistence use on those lands is evident. Within 30 years, one single generation, the potential for perpetuating the biological and cultural values of harvesting meat and fur from the forest will be severely restricted. One could hope, of course, that the more abundant public lands on the Tongass National Forest, which are managed for more varied uses than are the private lands, will continue to provide adequate resources for those dependent on wildlife for nutritional, economic, and cultural sustenance. Unfortunately, timber harvesting under the current Tongass Land Management Plan and the congressionally mandated allocation of 4.5 billion board feet of timber per decade to the forest industry in Alaska will result in similar, if less sudden and dramatic, effects on productivity and utility of the public lands as well. An indirect consequence of the aforementioned patterns is an inevitable increase in conflicts between subsistence and other user groups for the reduced wildlife resources on the remaining accessible public lands. This will likely accelerate the onset of the time when people begin to be excluded from the opportunity for traditional pursuits of wildlife. In your review of ANCSA as a model land claim settlement, I would advise you to consider the consequences of the establishment of profit-motivated corporations on the land-based activities of Alaskan Natives and others who rely on the wildlife resource. While the corporations may indeed have the best financial interests of their shareholders in mind, it is my considered opinion that their activities will have dire consequences on the subsistence opportunities of those individuals. If, in fact, a purpose of providing the land selections was to establish a basis for perpetuation of subsistence opportunities on lands free of competition from other user groups, some form of land tenure other than corporations and/or stringent regulations to guide incompatible land use patterns should have been applied. Litigation between various Native groups regarding proposed timber harvests in traditional hunting areas is currently pending in Alaskan courts and gives evidence to the direction of progress under the terms of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Unless the law, the corporate policies, or people's cultural values change in the near future, subsistence opportunities will diminish and conflicts are bound to increase.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. You said that that on public lands, as well as private native corporate lands, the same tendency to diminish wildlife productivity can be observed.
That's correct.
But there are two different land use regimes. Could you just explain to me the difference in the land use regimes? Because you said that there are more stringent regulations applicable to the public lands.
Correct. Okay. On the Forest Service lands, the Forest Service is charged with managing for a broad range of multiple uses, and there are several federal acts which affect the planning process, the size of clear cuts, the frequency with which an area can be entered and harvested, the amount of commercial forest land that is to be set aside to be retained as wildlife habitat. All of those, it's a fairly complex system of regulating timber harvesting on public lands, and the Forest Service makes all its decisions through the public NEPA processes, through public meetings and so forth.
Well, the timber operators
don't own the trees. They are given the right to cut them by the federal government.
That's correct.
And the U.S. Forest Service is under the Department of Agriculture.
That's correct. Right. And the whole process is conducted with a great deal of public input and takes into consideration a wide range of values, or a wider range of values than apparently is currently influencing harvest on the private lands. Private holdings, the Native Corporation timber harvesting activities, there are no restrictions on the size of clear-cut units, for example, the rate at which timber is harvested, other than what the economics dictate.
Well, who regulates the private timber operations?
There are, under the state laws, the State Forest Practices Act, there are some regulations with respect to primarily utilization standards, I believe, and also the under the Fish and Game Code, there is provided protection for anadromous fish streams, spawning streams for salmon and so forth. But other than that, there's very little regulation of the timber harvesting on private lands.
Well, besides the native corporations, are there any other private landholders engaged in on whose land timber operations are being carried on in Southeast Alaska?
I'm not aware of any other private landholders. In addition to the natives and the Forest Service, the state has state-selected lands, and there is logging, timber harvesting being undertaken on state lands.
Well, are they subject then to the same regime as the private lands under state jurisdiction?
The state lands, I believe, are under somewhat more restriction than the private landowners, but still much less than the federal lands.
And you, the outcome of all of this, you say, is that with reduced biological productivity on the private, native, corporate-owned timberlands, that is, the populations of deer and other subsistence species will be diminished, leading to a heightened conflict among various subsistence users. Well, I think that summarizes your case. Mm-hmm. Well, could you just talk a little bit about that conflict for a moment? You're talking about native subsistence users, non-native subsistence users, and I suppose as well the claims of sports users. Could you make any observations on that that you deem appropriate?
Well, as the human population continues to increase in Southeast Alaska, whether regardless of what user group you fall into, whether it's a native subsistence user, non-native subsistence user, or other recreational or sport hunter, whatever you wish to call it, what we're facing is a continual decline in the productivity of the land associated with alterations of the old growth forest. And we've got a reduced supply of wildlife resources and an increasing demand for those resources as populations increase. So the outcome of that will be arrival at that point where various user groups have to be restricted to a greater extent than they currently are, that much sooner, because we're working at the system from both ends, both the supply and the demand end of the scale.
Well, you have a unified subsistence management regime in Alaska that is on federal and state lands. It's mm-hmm. the state that enforces the subsistence priority.
Right.
Are you able to make any observations about Southeast Alaska or Alaska generally and the proportions of native to non-native subsistence users
I don't have any information on that.
Well, thank you very much. Is it possible to let us have your statement?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. This is May 22nd.